We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From WILL, Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. Our technical directors are Jason Croft and Evan Whitney. Jessica Stern is an expert on terrorism. Stern, who served as a staff member of the National Security Council during the Clinton administration, has traveled the world to talk to terrorists. Although she didn't recognize it at the time, she became immersed in the work as a way to deal with the trauma she experienced as the victim of a violent crime. Rather than being terrified of violence, she studied it. Jessica Stern, the author of Denial, A Memoir of Terror, is our guest this morning. On the 1st of October, 1973, 15-year-old Jessica Stern and her 14-year-old sister were raped at gunpoint in their Concord, Massachusetts home. They were home alone in what was seen as a safe neighborhood in a safe town. No one was ever arrested for the crimes. Stern says she brushed aside the memory of it. At the outset of her memoir, she says she and her sister went on to lead relatively happy and productive lives. But then she says while she could talk to terrorists without being afraid, situations that most people would not find frightening left her shaken. A therapist suggested she might have post-traumatic stress disorder. She was doubtful. In 2006, though, she decided to revisit what had happened to her. Listeners, you may join the discussion this morning with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest, Jessica Stern, lectures on terrorism at Harvard University and is a member of the Hoover Institution Task Force on National Security and Law. She's the author of the book Terror in the Name of God and the Ultimate Terrorists. Her memoir, Denial, A Memoir of Terror, is published by Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, will-talk@illinois.edu. Jessica Stern, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
What led you in 2006 to ask for that police file?
Well, I had written a little vignette about what it feels like to be terrorized in what was to be my third book on terrorism. And my editor just said, I think you should throw out the book and write about this rape. And I was so annoyed with him, I didn't even bother responding. But I did get that file. And when the police officer who gave it to me redacted the file, he realized that it looked like a serial rapist of children. And pedophiles generally keep going. They don't stop. So he reopened the case and discovered that, indeed, it was a serial rapist of children, and he felt that he identified 44 victims.
Hmm. He wanted your help in this, but he didn't want to re-traumatize you. Were you at all hesitant about opening that file and joining forces, essentially, with this police lieutenant in Concord, Massachusetts?
No, I really wasn't hesitant, and I should have been hesitant. I don't think this is a typical response to trauma of that kind. Most people don't want to revisit the trauma in that way. People often ask me, is this a good way to recover from a rape? And I would say no. What happened was I did experience altered states that I had experienced much of my life, not understanding that they were symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, and I describe them on the page. So this is a true crime story, and sometimes it's actually categorized as true crime in bookstores. But what I'm really trying to do is show what it feels like to have post-traumatic stress disorder, both for victims and family members.
Where do bookstores place this book? It could be in political science.
Yes, it's very hard, I think, to figure out where to place it. It is sometimes put in true crime, sometimes put in psychology, sometimes in memoir. And you're right, it could be put in political science, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I thought about picking up and putting the book down, because that's what I had to do, was I thought about rape as a weapon of war and how it's meant to humiliate, among other things. It's been likened to genocide. Has reflecting on your experience given you any new insights into rape as a weapon of war?
It has, actually. I learned, first of all, about my own feelings, which I had run away from, and I learned how deeply shamed and humiliated I felt. But in addition, I investigated very thoroughly my rapist, and I talked to everyone that I could find who was alive who knew him. And I believe that he was a victim of clergy sexual abuse. I can't prove it. Nobody talked about those things in the 50s. But he grew up in an area that really was a dumping ground for pedophile priests. And there were a series of three pedophile priests at his church, although it was later. I don't know whether that kind of dumping of pedophiles occurred when the rapist was a child. And there were rumors about sexual abuse of boys at his school. Again, I wasn't able to prove it, but it seemed likely partly because of the ritualistic aspect of his rapes. And I came to believe that rape is a way to kind of discharge shame and almost inject one's own shame into the victim. It's a contagious disease, I came to believe.
Yeah. How tragic that becoming a victim could push you into becoming a perpetrator.
Well, yes. I mean, most victims do not become perpetrators.
Right.
That's very important to emphasize. But most perpetrators, according to people who study prison populations, have been victimized in some way. So those are very different statistics. Most people who are victimized do not go out and hurt other people.
Yeah. One of the things you have to say about denial is this. I think it's very interesting. Denial helps the bystander.
Yes, we really do not want to know the terrible things that happen to people in our communities. It's much easier to go on not thinking about how boys have been preyed upon by priests, or in the case of my sister and me, that there's two young girls who have been raped by a stranger. The police didn't believe us. They thought that we were lying to them.
And one of the people you interviewed for the book didn't want his girlfriend, a woman from Turkey, to know that he had talked with you. He said, first, he said, she believed, this is the girlfriend, rape to be the woman's fault, and two, women who say they've been raped in Turkey may be killed. This is, you know, something we've termed honor killings, so-called. Talk about that, would you?
Yes. I mean, this person that I was interviewing, I mean, he made it very clear that he was afraid to talk to her, partly because he was afraid that he would hear that she had been raped too, and he did not want to hear it. It was too much for him to bear. And I was impressed that he was prepared to confess that feeling. But in addition, he did say how shocking it was for his Turkish girlfriend because people just didn't talk about rape where she grew up, in the part of Turkey where she grew up, where it really would be dangerous to talk about it.
Hmm. After describing what happened to you the night of the rape, early in a chapter in the book, you say this: "I have listened and I have been quiet all my life, but now I will speak." How powerful has it been to speak, to tell this story? I also imagine it's been very difficult.
It actually is surprisingly difficult to talk about, but in fact harder to talk about than write about, because writing, I'm in control how much I can stand. I can take a vacation from it, run away and talk to terrorists, which is what I kept saying to my editor. I'm taking a terrorism vacation from my book. But I'll tell you, there's another side, and that is it is so gratifying to hear from people who read the book and say, "You understand me." They write me letters. One wrote me, "You know me." Because I described states of mind that she didn't know other people felt. And that was the same thing for me. I had these altered states, never talked to anyone about it. I thought it was just me. I mean, I just thought it was part of my character. Well, it turns out my father has the same thing, and the two of us never mentioned it to each other. Mm-hmm. And now people are writing to me and saying the same thing. And men and women who were raped as children, refugees from, one from Romania, people who have been traumatized in various ways have written to say that the book was really healing for them. And that, of course, is very gratifying to me. It's overwhelming, but it does, of course, make it all seem worthwhile.
Hmm. Well, I want to thank you here at this point for talking with us this afternoon. I know it's difficult, but I think it's such an important thing to do. So thank you.
Thank you.
Jessica Stern is our guest this morning here on Focus. She is the author most recently of Denial, a memoir of terror. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you may join us this morning with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take a call from a listener in Effingham, line 4. Good morning.
Yes, thank you for taking the call, Celeste. I have a couple of questions. The first one I would ask your guest, if he understands what has become patriarchy.
I don't know. Does the listener want to...
Okay. I thought maybe just one word would suffice.
Okay.
If it doesn't, then I would add that the patriarchal paradigm, which occurred some long time ago, and the power of men, males, over everything, and the violence with which that has been carried out from the early beginnings of it, I think 50,000 years ago to the present. And I'm wondering if your guest understands that paradigm by which we now live.
Well, thanks for the clarification, and I think Jessica Stern can now take that and do something with it.
Well, I'll do my best.
Yeah.
I think that the caller is right, that we do live even today, a patriarchal society, and that's true even more in some other countries. And I was thinking as I was writing some of the time about women in Pakistan. Indeed, I've received letters from women in Pakistan, I mean, and other societies, but I have a lot of connections in Pakistan where it's such a patriarchal society, and where women really... There are these honor killings, and I was feeling that there are some places where women cannot speak out. It's not just that they don't want to. It's that they're putting their lives in jeopardy. And obviously, I think that's a tragedy.
Does the listener want to follow up?
If I could, that practice now has become so ingrained within the human population, or the population over, I'm trying to refrain from ending some of my words in man, which is erroneous. The patriarchal beginnings had to have been the paternalist influence over matriarchs, which was a degeneration of maternal life, the management of the society. And when that devolved and paternalists, rotted paternalists, I call them, began to assume the power that she had by no choice to evolve because of population. The expansion of that, and how then instead of maternal instincts, then it became power instincts to control. When men saw that, they took it from her and killed the matriarch, and then it's all been downhill since. And the last thing I want to leave you with is, so far as I know, and I study everything I can, that the people who exist now, both femmes and males, have been accustomed to same species murder, which is we are the only species that practices that with the sort of venom that that occurs now. And therein, I think, lies the whole of problems. And if there's ever going to be a cure, then the today's femmes will have to come forward and stop that, if it is possible to do. And males have great power, and they use it to their own benefit, and which is now concentrated at the top, you know, the bourgeoisie around the world, and then the underlings who function under those patriarchs. So,
okay. Well, thanks for the call. Jessica, any last thoughts there?
Well, I appreciate the caller's remarks. I do think that this is an extreme problem in some parts of the world, and my heart really goes out to women in places where they are really at risk for talking about harm to themselves.
One of the things you say in your memoir, Denial, is that you've been spying on violent men for much of your life. When and how did you come to the work of talking to terrorists?
I'm really not trained to talk to anybody. I don't really have a license to talk to people. My degrees are in chemistry and chemical engineering and policy. And I had been working on the prospect for terrorists to use weapons of mass destruction, which is completely consistent with my training. But I got very curious, and I started actually calling terrorists on the phone. And I realized that they really wanted to talk to me, and that I was good at getting them to talk. Indeed, people often ask me, how do I get them to talk? It's a problem is much more to get them to shut up than to get them to talk. They really wanted to talk to me, and I realized, well, okay, I'm not an anthropologist or a psychologist, but they seem to feel at ease talking to me, and I should just take advantage of whatever it was about my personality that made it possible to do that work. And I now believe it is because of my own exposure to violence, but I hadn't put those two things together until I wrote this book.
How do you begin a conversation with a terrorist?
You ask him about himself. I tried to stay away from topics that would make me look as if I were working for an intelligence agency or make me seem threatening. I was most interested in topics that were about personal motivations, because that's something you cannot tease out of the kind of data that's normally collected. So I wanted to find things out that you don't find in the library or you don't find in government databases, that you can't discover from a large end study.
And what have you learned about terrorists as a result of your conversations with them?
Well, I think the most important thing I learned about contemporary so-called jihadi terrorists especially is the role of humiliation. And that doesn't mean that all terrorism throughout the history of terrorism has been motivated by humiliation, but I do think that today's jihadi terrorism is, and there's the perception that Islamic civilization has fallen behind politically, intellectually, financially, and terrorist leaders describe that situation as humiliating and explain that the way to overcome that feeling of humiliation is to get involved in a violent jihad. And unfortunately, they have a powerful message, and they are speaking to a group that is ready to hear that message.
So if humiliation is part of the root cause, how do you put an end to humiliation?
Well, humiliation, first of all, is a feeling, and it can be deliberately inculcated. Cynical leaders can try to make followers feel humiliated and claim that the source of that humiliation is the West. So that's the first thing. It could be, and I think actually is, essentially made up. It's a kind of weapon. But I think they may be capitalizing on a feeling, a genuine feeling of humiliation, which doesn't necessarily come from globalization. May come from other things about what's going on in their own societies. How is there an obvious countermeasure? Can you run a war on humiliation? Well, you know, humiliation exists all over the world, and most places it doesn't cause terrorism. It's a risk factor for terrorism in some situations, and we think it may be that it's a risk factor in honor cultures, where a person feels dissed and they react strongly, harshly, perhaps violently, whereas in other cultures that might not be the response.
You say you felt at some level that if you could talk to terrorists, you could tame them and your world would be safer. You also came to realize this could make you sick. How did you come to the idea of taming terrorists, or how did you come to the realization that that's what you were trying to do?
It wasn't something I was consciously aware of, but once I started working on my own terror, I realized that asking questions was a way for me to, I think at some level, protect myself, to distract a perpetrator from hurting. It certainly didn't work in the case of my own rapist, because he said if we opened our mouths, he would kill us. So that was not... I can't pretend that I learned it from that experience. I don't know how that happened.
Yeah. Did your steely confidence in this area of your life ever put you at risk?
I think it did. Yeah. It was, I mean, I did exactly what Daniel Pearl did. I did it as a woman, which I think was protection. And the last time I was in Pakistan talking to jihadis was August 2001, and he did it shortly after September 11th. I mean, it's talking to members of Bin Laden's International Islamic Front for Americans is a very different prospect today from what it was prior to September 11th. But yes, I did. I would say I did some very foolish things.
Mm. And how and when did you realize your curiosity, this curiosity, could make you sick?
Well, the same curiosity that I felt that compelled me to seek out these terrorists, I did the same thing with people who knew my rapist. And there, I was really trying to feel the feeling, and the feeling was sickening. I wasn't running away from feeling. I was almost having to hypnotize myself to actually have what should be a natural feeling, which is horror that these friends of the man who rapes so many young girls were in denial about who he was. Almost invariably, they would say something to make clear that they knew more than they were letting on. By the time I left, they would have divulged something. But mostly, they were denying that he could have done anything so horrible.
Mm-hmm. How was he able to get away with this, Brian Beat?
It's actually quite astonishing. There were 20 attacks in an 8-block area right around Radcliffe. And one of the victims was the then 13-year-old daughter of a very beloved dean of Harvard Law School at the time. And she was rape number 12. I mean, that is incredible. Her younger sister had seen someone looking in the windows, and they said, oh, you're imagining things. Because, of course, nobody thought about rapists looking in windows at the time in a neighborhood like that. But there had been 11 previous attacks right in that neighborhood, and there would be another 8, and there would be right in that neighborhood. There were 20 right in that neighborhood. So he seemed to almost to be playing cat and mouse with the police. But part of it, I think, is that the police didn't warn the neighborhood. They didn't. There was a piece in the Harvard Crimson, and some of the students said, well, gosh, we think we've heard about some other rapes in this area. And a dean said, no, there haven't been. So it was covered up. It's something that I think is very unlikely. It's very unlikely it would happen today. But universities didn't want news getting out about rapes in the neighborhood.
Eventually, Brian Beat did go to prison. What happened there? And tell us then how he was able to not be designated a sexually dangerous person.
He did go to prison for 3 earlier rapes. He had been convicted and was incarcerated for 18 years. And during that period, he was evaluated to determine whether he was a, quote, sexually dangerous person. And for reasons I cannot explain, 2 times the psychiatrists who evaluated him said he was not sexually dangerous, even though they weren't doubting that he had raped 3 girls. They weren't suggesting that he was wrongfully convicted. They just concluded that he wasn't sexually dangerous.
How did you feel when you learned he was dead?
I had very complicated feelings. I had wanted to interview him. I had really planned on interviewing him. I felt that I knew how to do this. I'd interviewed so many terrorists. I was self-trained but very well-trained and by that time. And so I was actually a little bit disappointed. And that I also felt ashamed for being disappointed. It seemed so weird that I barely wanted to admit it to myself.
Yeah. How did you deal during the course of this exploration, this personal exploration, and then the investigation that you were part of? How did you deal with all the feelings that you were going through, whether it would be being wanting very much to talk with this fellow, feelings about angry feelings toward the psychiatrists, the police who bungled this. That's, for me as a reader, it's so much to handle. This is something that you have lived through.
Well, how I dealt with the feelings until I wrote this book was mainly not to feel them, which the problem with trying to deny one's feelings is that not just the bad feelings but also the good feelings are sort of submerged. And how I dealt with it in writing the book, well, writing, I think, can be very therapeutic. It can also be devastating. Mm-hmm. But for me to write about, to try to capture my rage on the page, was actually therapeutic. I think men sometimes read that rage and cross their legs. They're alarmed that a woman could be so rageful. But any victim of a sexual crime has those feelings. It's just, I think, inevitable. Mm.
Jessica Stern is our guest this morning on Focus in this portion of the program. She's an expert on terrorism. She served as a staff member of the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. She's traveled the world talking to terrorists. Although she didn't recognize it at the time, she became immersed in that work as a way to deal with the trauma she experienced as the victim of a violent crime. When she and her younger sister were in their teens, they were raped at gunpoint in their home in Concord, Massachusetts. Jessica Stern is the author of Denial, A Memoir of Terror. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning. Join the discussion with a phone call or by email, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email will-talk@illinois.edu. As part of the work for the book, you interviewed your father, and he told you of being a boy, a Jew in Nazi Germany, surviving the Holocaust. And one of the questions you asked him was, what was it like to feel afraid? What did he tell you?
Well, I wanted him to describe really the feeling, because I realized that fear was a kind of banished emotion. Well, lots of emotions were there was an unspoken rule in our household that you weren't supposed to be afraid, that and you weren't supposed to be sad. And so I was really trying to get my father to tell me, you know, what it felt like to be afraid in Nazi Germany. And he then told me stories that he'd never told anyone in our family about what happened when he was a child, including one instance where the Nazis came to the house and had some dealings with his mother while my dad and his sister were outside the door. And also he talked about his first sexual experience with the daughter of a Nazi and being hounded by children who were instructed to throw rocks at the Jewish children in the school. I'd never heard these stories, so I was shocked. I was shocked. My father and I just hadn't sat down and talked about these things. I mean, it was just kind of off limits. And so I think it was good for both of us.
One of the fascinating things that he told you was that he felt terror all day, all night, but he didn't know he was being terrorized.
No, I think it was just the air that he didn't notice until until he was no longer terrorized. But even when he came to America, he was scared of Boy Scouts and police. He just was scared of people in uniform. And my father, I think, had some trouble dealing with the police when my sister and I were raped. He told them not too long afterwards that he thought we were over it. And I can't help but think that part of it is that he had this almost, body reaction to police, that it was so ingrained in him that it was better to just stay away from them.
Yeah.
Just get them away as quickly as possible.
It is clear you have a strong bond. You describe your father as a remarkable man, a precious jewel, a strong man with a very gentle core. What did it mean having this discussion with him? You said it was good for the two of you. Maybe you would talk with us. What did you talk about in terms of denial?
Well, I really confronted my father with his own denial about what he did when the police, he was on a business trip when my sister and I were raped, and the family physician called him in when he was in Europe and said, "Your two daughters were just raped at gunpoint." And he didn't curtail his trip. And he thought it would just be more efficient to just come home as he had planned on his schedule. And I find this information so shocking that I kept forgetting it. But it's a trick of the mind. It's incredible that that can happen. But finally, I was able to keep it in mind long enough to confront him. And he and I kept asking him, "Don't you want to apologize for what you did?" And that, although he didn't say the words, "I am sorry," he did say that he thought that it would be even worse for us had he come home immediately. That basically he was admitting that he would not have been able to handle this. And I don't think it's all that uncommon from letters I'm getting during that period in the early 70s. I think fathers in particular, had a really, really hard time dealing with news about the rape of children. And I think of course, as a parent myself, I can't imagine digesting that information, especially that helplessness one would feel being so far away. But running away from the feeling, just that's what I was trying to get him to stop doing. And I think to some extent we managed to do that. And it's in the book partly as a model for others. It was hard. It was very, very hard to do it. And I did it. It took a long time. But I do think it's something worth doing. And so I put it out there, even though in some ways it was very embarrassing to put all that out there. I do think it's a good model.
Jessica Stern is our guest this morning on Focus. She is the author most recently of Denial, A Memoir of Terror. My name is Celeste Quinn. Let's take a call. A listener in Lake Bloomington on line 4. Hello.
Hi there. I wanted to go back to the psychiatrists who were interviewed, interviewed the rapist and declared that he was no danger. How can anybody have the temerity to do that? Whatever made them think it was possible for a psychiatrist to interview somebody and decide what they were capable of doing? Don't you think that's really wrong?
I do. I think it was a particular period in history, and when there was a kind of movement, a sympathy for those who were incarcerated, that certainly in this case seems to have gone way too far. I mean, this was, even though they didn't know how many attacks, and there may be many more than the 44 that the police now think they identified, they didn't know, but they did know that he'd been convicted of three rapes. And this man was let out into the community after 18 years, and he was not put on the list of dangerous sexual predators, and he was seen spending time with high school kids. He made an exchange with them. He would buy beer for them, and then they would give him some beer. And in fact, when he was just about to be put on that list, that's when he hung himself. But we don't know what he was doing after he was let out of prison. I don't know whether there are other victims. Indeed, he's a suspect in a murder and abduction. So, yes, it was wrong on every level.
Wow. I'm simply outraged. And I just, it just makes me furious to think that could have happened.
Yes. Well, I do think that we've made some progress, but let's make sure that it never happens again.
Yes, I'm comforted to hear that there has been progress. Thank you so much for telling your story.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us with a question, a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. It seems that we, on the one hand, we need denial to get us to a certain place where we can stop and look back and sort things out. What do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, if we sat around thinking that every second we're a second closer to death, we wouldn't
get out of bed in the morning.
Right. And I think it's figuring out what is healthy denial, what is helping us get through the day with no harm to others, and what is hurting. And yes, I certainly agree with you. We need denial, but some denial is really harmful to others. And I think when we see the pain of others and we think it's just unpleasant to actually see, not just with our eyes, but take it in, that's when I think it can be a kind of almost another assault.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Good morning.
Hi. I've been a victim of abuse by a parent. I'm now 53 years old. My parents are approaching 80. At what point, you know, do you consider, you know, I've done a lot of work on this. I've, you know, felt some comfort on my own. At what point, you know, do I decide they're just too old, you know, to bother anymore, that I don't need their acceptance, you know, of what they did?
Well, you don't. you don't. That's right. And I feel very fortunate that I was able to have this kind of conversation with my then 80-year-old father. And my father and I are now, he's 82, I guess he was 79. We're going biking together down the Danube River. I feel very, very lucky, but I wouldn't say that I needed this from my father. I mean, the work really has to be internal. In a way, I was trying to help my father because I felt that he was plagued without knowing it by what happened and what he did. And so we had this conversation, and I'm certainly glad we did, but I don't think that we need at age 53 necessarily to have that conversation in order to move on. And I also want to be clear that I'm not making any excuses for myself, that although these things happen to me, I don't see them as an excuse for I don't see myself as a victim who has an excuse for not getting on with my own life. I think that we're all responsible for taking care of ourselves, and it, you know, I'm just fortunate that my father was able to have this conversation.
Right. So you're not proposing that everyone necessarily have that conversation with a parent?
No, I don't. I don't. I mean, it sounds like you have to figure out whether it's mm-hmm. good for all parties. Is it? And in my case, I think it was good for all parties.
Yeah, gotcha. All right, well, thank you.
Thanks for the call this morning. 333-9455-800-222-9455. will-talk@illinois.edu. Any advice for working through, in, for example, in this gentleman's case, working through what he's feeling? You writing helped you a lot.
Yes, I think it's important to realize that trauma is part of life, and everyone is traumatized. And there's big trauma, there's small trauma, and there's also the kind of trauma that, if one is unlucky, one can end up with post-traumatic stress disorder, a threat to one's life, for example. Violent rape is a major risk factor for post-traumatic stress disorder, which I didn't know until I had finished my book. But there is also the possibility of post-traumatic growth. And I think that is, especially with treatment, one can learn to use the kind of altered states that a person with PTSD suffers from or benefits from. You can learn to use those states productively in your life. And I also think that even as one could be suffering the bad effects of trauma, one also can become more empathetic to others. So I think it's important to bear in mind that this is a part of life, and there are benefits as well as costs. Hmm.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Champaign on line one. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to comment about the psychiatrist who opined that the rapist was not dangerous, not at all to justify that decision, but rather to comment, psychiatry in the public sector then and now frequently serves the agenda of whatever department or agency in which they work, and many, many very poor, unjust decisions. The most notable in these days is competency to stand trial, but there are a myriad of others. And it just that public psychiatry is very poor, in my judgment, unethical, and is a major problem that the public is largely, if not totally, unaware of. I know because I'm a retired psychiatrist and had to deal with that sort of thing very frequently in my professional life. And that's really my comment.
Well, thank you.
Well, that's very helpful. I actually talked to one of the psychiatrists involved at Bridgewater State Hospital at the time, where this evaluation took place, and he did explain that to me. But thank you so much for telling us that this comes out of your own experience. That is very, very interesting, and I think I needed it explained to me, and thank you for reminding me of that.
Let's take another call. Also, a listener in Champaign, line two. Hi.
Hi, I'm a trauma therapist, and I just want to say that I think that the response about that if somebody needs to work, that it doesn't need to be with an elderly parent, but if things are unresolved, lots of the trauma, they are held in a different side of the brain, which is not language-oriented. So that's why there's so many flashbacks. in dreams, so that the processing that can be done, you know, in a broader way would be helpful. So that's my comment.
Yes, thank you for saying that. There, I have a list on my website of resources, and it is more and more trauma specialists are encouraging survivors to do body-based therapies, including practicing yoga, which I highly recommend because a person can sort of almost jump out of their body and they need to get back in. And I think yoga really helps with that. And there are other therapies that are sometimes helpful, like EMDR, and new therapies being discovered all the time. There's a lot of research underway right now because of so many veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Hmm. What is EMDR?
That is using the movement of the eye to help a person overcome the impact of a trauma. And I don't think people really understand how and why it works, but some people really believe in it, and others believe that it can be dangerous if used in the wrong hands. But nonetheless, it's one of the resources out there that each person needs to discover the right one for themselves.
Yeah. To wrap up here, Jessica, tell us your website.
It's jessicasternbooks.com, and there is a resources page, which I hope people will find useful.
Hmm. Jessica Stern, thank you so much for talking with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jessica Stern, she is the author of Denial, A Memoir of Terror. The book is published by Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins.